Thanks for tuning in. Host Noah Weil is a licensed attorney admitted to practice in Washington State and the Federal Court of the Western District of Washington. Some guests on this program may be licensed attorneys as well. However, the discussion on this podcast is intended to be informative only and is not a substitute for legal advice for your particular situation. The information may be right or may be wrong. Changing laws and the laws of individual states mean the information presented here may not be accurate. But regardless, and this part is important, neither Noah nor any guest here is your lawyer. If you need a lawyer for your individual situation, you should consult and retain your own attorney.
Now, I heard there's a code phrase. You can tell an officer that they're arresting you, and you can tell them the secret phrase, and they'll say, "Oh, I'm sorry, sir," and then they'll let you go and just be on your way. Is that true?
A code phrase?
Yeah, some kind of magic statement that just is like, "Oh, I must have made it. I didn't know you knew the phrase."
Oh, no.
No, nothing like
never
that?
Never heard it, no.
No? Okay. No. Well, I guess I'll keep looking then.
All right.
But you mentioned staying silent.
Right.
Does that make officers angry if they're doing an interrogation, a custodial kind of situation, and the person's like, "No, I'm going to be silent." I read Noah Weil's blog. He says, "Don't talk to the cops," which obviously I'm not following my own advice for today. But how do police officers, how do you feel about that? How do you think police officers feel about it generally?
Personally, it doesn't matter to me. I mean, if you want to talk, you don't want to talk. Who am I to come in and make you talk or get angry about it? I mean, it's your right not to talk. So don't talk. That's your constitutional right not to speak with us. Some officers get frustrated by it, but then I look at it from the standpoint, well, the guy doesn't want to talk. He doesn't want to talk. He doesn't want to talk. Okay. You know, all we have then is we make a decision based on evidence available to us, and he doesn't want to provide his input, and we're faced with what we're faced with. And they might be able to tell us something that explains their involvement in certain activity that would make us let them go. That's happened. Or they might incriminate themselves. It just depends on the circumstances.
If you were arrested or under suspicion for some crime, guilty or not, mm-hmm. would you talk to the police?
I might. There was a use of force case involving a police officer, and I'm not going to talk about which department it was or mention any names, but it happened here in Washington State where a police officer was charged with a pretty serious offense. And I think the reason he was charged is because he was given his Miranda rights and he didn't provide a statement. I think if he had provided a statement to the prosecuting attorney, that he probably would not have been charged with the crime he was charged with. Now, ultimately, he was acquitted because he took the stand in his own defense. But what if he'd taken the stand in his own defense before he was even charged? So I think in a case like that, it would have been beneficial for him to talk to the police in the prosecuting attorney's office, but he chose not to, and he ended up getting charged with a pretty serious criminal offense. He was ultimately acquitted. But if I had something to say that was in my defense, I might. I might talk to the police. I might talk to a prosecuting attorney.
Call me first.
Okay.
And here's the reason that I say that. I think your story actually is in a perfect example because he was charged with a crime, and that's terribly stressful. It's expensive. Nobody wants to be charged with a crime.
No.
The only thing worse than being charged with a crime is being convicted of a crime.
Right.
And, you know, people think of themselves more clever than they are. I think they can explain away a lot of things. And I think what you've said is once you've made an arrest decision, it's probably going to go forward. There isn't a magic phrase. Maybe there is something in this one specific instance they can say. But I think a lot of the times your mind's made up and you're recording them and they're just going to talk themselves into a corner and the prosecutor's going to have a field day with all their statements that are either internally inconsistent or just straight up incriminating. I still advocate that keep your mouth shut. Don't try to explain what really happened. Let your lawyer do that for you. When you're going to take the stand, take the stand, but then you'll have the benefit of an attorney working with you to make sure that your testimony is consistent and it makes sense and it's, you know, the whole truth, that
sure.
kind of thing. That's my advice. I do feel like the cases where you can talk yourself out of being arrested are much smaller than the cases where you talk yourself into worse trouble. And I have to ask, have you seen that in your line of work?
Where talk themselves into trouble?
Yes.
Oh, yes.
That would have been better if they had just stayed sober.
I couldn't say the alphabet if I was sober. Yeah. I've only had two beers.
Yeah.
Two blocks from home.
So you've seen it. There's people that talk themselves into trouble. I've seen it,
sure.
You've seen it. I think it's best practices just to be quiet. But I also agree with you completely that, God, don't resist arrest. Don't put up a fight. It's just not going to end well, and it's going to get somebody hurt.
No, I remember we make a stop based on reasonable suspicion or an arrest based on probable cause, or and whether we're right or wrong won't be decided until later. And the only one really gets to decide if I had a reasonable suspicion to make a stop, a Terry stop, or probable cause to make an arrest is a judge. Nobody else gets to make really. I mean, a prosecutor can decide. From a standpoint of not filing a charge that had no probable cause or reasonable suspicion. But ultimately, that question is answered by a judge, and whether I had probable cause or reasonable suspicion. And when you look into what defines both of those terms, it's pretty comprehensive. There's a lot involved in that. And you can't have that kind of an examination conducted out in the field when you're out stopping and talking to people making the arrests. That's done in a courtroom in one form or another, either in a criminal case or in a lawsuit.
So what's the stops? Let's say you stop a car for a traffic infraction, mm-hmm. and you come to the window and you smell the odor of intoxicants. Mm-hmm. Maybe their eyes are bloodshot, maybe
yep.
watery. And I'm laughing to myself because this is every police report I've ever read, but what's going through your mind? What are your next steps on a potential DUI arrest?
Well, what I do is I start picking things up with my senses. I'm listening to their speech, and I'm trying to figure out what I'm smelling with my nose, and what I see in their eyes and in their face and their mannerisms, and how our interaction is going. And then I'll approach it from two different standpoints. Either I'll say, I can tell you've been drinking tonight. How much have you had? And what that might do with somebody is put them on a spot where they might say, well, you know what? I'm not going to lie to the guy because he already knows I've been drinking. So I'll tell them two beers, which is the common response, two beers, right? Because nobody ever goes out and has one beer. They've always had at least one beer, but probably many more. But they know that I'll believe two. But I'm a lot less likely to believe one.
I'm not going to lie to the guy, but I will tell the most common lie possible.
Yeah, exactly. Or I'll say, have you been drinking tonight? I'll ask that question, have you been drinking tonight? And then they might say, well, yeah, I've had four glasses of wine and, you know, whatever. It just depends on how I read the person, how I'll pose that question. Depending on how they appear to me at the time, it's obvious they've been consuming alcohol, and it's so obvious to me that I'll know it when I walk up to the car door and interact with them, then it'll cause me to want them to do field tests if they will cooperate with them. So I'll go back to my car and I'll focus my camera because I try to do everything I possibly can on my video camera. I want everything as much as I possibly can put on that video on my video and record it. So I'll ask them out of the car, and then if they refuse to get out of the car, like I had one here a couple weeks ago that the guy didn't want to get out of the car, and then we sort of have this conversation about, look, if you don't step out of the car at this point, I'll have to order you out of the car. And if you don't want to cooperate then, I just have more cops showing up, and then we just take you out of the car. And one way or the other, we're going to get you out of the car. So you might as well do it the easy way. And so we saw the light, and you got out of the car. I rarely get anybody out to fight out of the car because they usually will see the light and get out of the car. And then we go make our way over to the sidewalk, and at that point, you know, one could argue that if you order somebody out of the car, it's a pretty significant intrusion into their liberty. You might want to give them Miranda rights at that point. Maybe, maybe not. Or if they cooperate, we walk over to the sidewalk and I'll explain them. Again, they're being audio and video recorded, and I can tell you've been drinking tonight. My objective tonight is to determine if your ability to drive is impaired by alcohol or drugs. I do that by asking people to do some tests. on the roadside, and the tests are voluntary. And then most people say, well, yeah, I'll do the tests. Then we get into the field sobriety tests. But I don't have to have those tests to make an arrest decision. If they refuse, I can consider that as part of my probable cause to make an arrest. Push comes to shove, you're better off making the arrest than you aren't putting that person back behind the wheel of their car and having them flat in a family of five in a crosswalk. So push comes to shove, in the name of public safety, you've got obvious signs of impairment, then you're better off making the arrest.
Do you think a potential defendant that doesn't want to be arrested or doesn't want to be convicted of a crime, do you think it's better or worse for them to refuse to do the field sobriety test?
That's hard to say because, you know, there are people that I clear that do the field test that I clear that I see, well, yeah, you've been drinking, but not to the point where I think you've had too much to safely drive a car. Mm-hmm. I had one a few weeks ago that I put through all the tests after traffic collision, and she wouldn't do the PBT, the portable breath test, which would have been proof positive, right? I mean, that gives me a breath sample right there on the spot. But based on everything else that I saw, there was an explanation for some of the things that she didn't do good on, and I wasn't seeing the big stuff that I really latch on to as far as gauging if somebody's impaired, like gaze nystagmus wasn't there, that sort of thing. So there's somebody who refused the PBT but did everything else that I actually cleared.
And she got back in her car?
No, she could. The car was totaled.
Okay.
But I would have let her drive if I would have allowed her to drive after that. So there's always that chance that you're going to prove to me through the field test that you're not impaired. I'll send you on your way in that case. But if I think you're impaired, then you're under arrest.
Do you think some officers get mad when someone doesn't do their field tests on the road?
You know, I work largely by myself. I have heard of officers who get mad. As a matter of fact, I've got I call him a little brother, a kid I helped raise, living in East Washington, that much to my disappointment got stopped by the state patrol over there in the middle of the night. Driving out his lights on at the tender age of 18, he'd been drinking. And he refused to do the tests, and the trooper told him, either you do the tests or I'm going to arrest you. And so I don't remember if he did the tests or not.
It doesn't sound very lawful to me.
And, no, it doesn't.
I'm not saying I'm a criminal defense attorney.
But I didn't like it either. I forget if he did the tests or not, but he said the trooper was mad because he wouldn't do the field tests. And I said, well, yeah, I can't answer that. I wasn't there, Brandon. So I'm just mentioning his name. I wasn't there. Nevertheless, he got arrested, and he ended up swinging a deal because of evidence problem at the time. It was statewide with the breath test. But that didn't work out too good for him. The trooper got mad. I don't get mad at that stuff. I figured, is that your right not to do the test? Why should I get mad about that? Why should I get angry? Why should I take it personally? I mean, my paycheck shows up every other Thursday, whether you answer my questions or not, or do the test, I'm still going to get paid Thursday. I mean, so.
I agree, except I see so many members of the force seem to get very offended when you're not cooperating with their investigation.
Well, again, and you know, I'm not them, I guess. I just, it doesn't bother me. If you don't want to answer my questions and do my tests, then God bless you. I guess, you know.
We talked a little bit about bad seeds in the force.
Sure.
And then we talked about the investment the city puts in for officers and trying to keep them around, if it makes sense. Obviously,
sure.
If they're really egregious, they're gone. But how difficult do you think it is for other officers to assist in making sure the bad police do not stay there?
You know, I think that well, it's easier today than it ever has been as far as, you know, if you have a problem with an officer, what an officer has done, you can make a complaint. It's upsetting, I think. It has to be, for someone to get fired here, you have to be way out of line. I mean, you really have to be wrong, big time wrong, to get canned. If there's a way we can salvage a career, the person is still a valuable asset to the department. Trying to correct a behavior that's either dangerous to themselves or their officers or to the public. Just depending on what it is, I think it's worth approaching it from the standpoint that you want to make things better for everybody by coming out and calling somebody's attention. And I've had to do that a few times myself. And there's one instance where the behavior of the officer was so outrageous that it was recommended to be fired because of what was going on. In those cases, it's out of my control, but I also have to do what's right for myself and the police department and my own well-being as well. And I think other officers have to look at that from the same perspective.
You know what I'm saying, though, right? That there's a belief in the public that officers will protect each other and that they won't allow an officer to be exposed to those proceedings because the individual members of the force, the partners and such, are more important than the department itself.
I don't think that if there's a perception of that today. Well, we've got everything's video recorded. Not so much as it used to be.
Okay.
I think there's that spirit of camaraderie still exists, but it's not as strong as it used to be, I don't think. And of course, there was a standard of what would and would not constitute serious misconduct. You're much less likely to escape consequences for that kind of thing today when you look at the technology we're working with.
Yeah, you've talked about it a few times. You've said that you really want all your interactions to be on camera.
Absolutely. Just about everything I do is at least video recorded, if not both audio and video recorded.
Why is it better for the officers that it's all recorded?
I think it protects us. Mm-hmm. It does. I mean, when you look at the video camera in the police car, video cameras in any area in the precinct where we interact with the suspect, the holding rooms, the breath test rooms, everything but the restroom, of course. But if there's an allegation that something's used improper force or a denial that this guy assaulted you, and of course, we turn the tables. There have been some cases where officers have been found to be wrong based on what's on that video. From my perspective, it protects me. It heads a lot of that off. It's in my favor to have everything video and audio recorded because then I've got my evidence to back me up.
Do you think all the police departments across the country should be equipped with cameras?
I think today we should be, yeah. I think so. My one concern about body cameras is the privacy. You know, as a police officer, I don't have my privacy is lessened and different than it is for the general public because I'm on the public's dime when I'm out doing my job, and so they have a right to see what I'm doing, to know what I'm doing with their money. Essentially, I'm getting paid by them, so they should have the right within a reasonable level to know what I'm doing. So I have no problem being recorded while I'm doing my job as a police officer. My bigger concern, though, is the privacy of the general public when we're walking into people's houses with those body cameras rolling, and you're recording the insides of people's houses and their valuables and the state of mind that they're in when the police are inside and their kids and their personal area that's not going to be protected from public disclosure. So when we walk into someone's house and a family fight, mom and dad are having a problem and little kids are around and all of a sudden that's on the TV or on YouTube, I've got a lot of concerns about that. And that's stuff that's going to have to be looked at, I think, by the state, by the legislature, before we actually start putting any kind of body camera into play here, because we're going into people's personal lives and personal. But what happens on the street is a different story. That's free. That's free game. Mm-hmm. But inside someone's house and in their private areas, we're recording that stuff, and we're actually as government agents. And then the YouTube can be on YouTube. All of a sudden, this whole thing is a your family fights a YouTube sensation. That's a problem for me, I think.
It sounds like, in general, you're for recording. It's just making sure that the public's privacy is protected.
I think so. I think it's a given. We don't have the same level of privacy as a police officer on the job. Now, off-duty is a little different story. I think we're a little more protection for us there. But when we're on the job, we really don't have a right to privacy. At least it's limited. You know, you wouldn't like to have a body camera rolling when I'm facing northbound in the men's restroom taking a leak or something. Maybe you wouldn't want to do that. But when we're out interacting with the public, interacting with prisoners, investigating crimes, that kind of stuff, of course you want that camera on because it protects you.
in my experience, the most common reason for an officer to go into someone's home, especially when there's people in there, is a domestic violence call.
That's right. Yes.
And for me, in my work, I think domestic violence is some of the most interesting and challenging work that I do.
Yes.
How do you feel about domestic violence?
I agree. You know, it's I shot somebody in a domestic violence setting here back in 1997, and it proved to me, not that I wasn't convinced earlier, that those are probably the most dangerous calls to go on because emotions are already heightened. You know, you got that passion is all mixed up in that, and then the police show up, and we're threatening people's liberty and the status quo of the family, and someone, you know, no one's going to be happy when we leave there with mom or dad in handcuffs, or a brother or sister in handcuffs, and you know, there's going to be remorse, there's going to be hurt feelings, and someone's going off to jail, and we don't like breaking up families like that either. It's no fun for us either to go and ruin people's lives like that as well, but that's the law.
And I think what a lot of people don't realize is that if you're going to a DV call, you're almost required to make an arrest and put somebody in handcuffs.
Just about. It's not that simple. We have to have probable cause to make an arrest, certainly. But there's very little discretion. Very little discretion. When there's probable cause to arrest somebody for an assault or a threat in a domestic violence relationship, we pretty much, the suspect is available, we have to make that arrest. We don't have the discretion of letting somebody go like we do with someone drinking a beer on a stairway, or who's going 5 miles an hour with a speed limit. We don't have that discretion. The public in a domestic violence setting, they're not in the mindset to appreciate what our consequences are if we don't do our jobs right. And right now they're thinking of what this loss means to them. And that's what makes those situations very, very volatile.
My last guest here, David Greenspan, we talked about mandatory minimum sentencing, mm-hmm. and how he was unhappy and agreed that the discretion was being taken away from judges on some crimes. In this case, the discretion is being taken away from police officers.
Yes.
Do you think that's a good policy?
Well, it certainly has drawbacks. As I mentioned earlier, early in my career, very early in my career, I could go to a family fight, family disturbance, and in a lot of cases, settle it by just talking to people and getting them focused on what's more important and trying to help people work through their issues, which is actually a lot more challenging, maybe a lot more fun than just putting handcuffs on somebody, yarding them off, putting them in jail for a crime. And if I thought it was appropriate, make an arrest if you thought you had to under the circumstances. But that wasn't working for some people. And they wanted the law enforced, so they changed the law, and they enacted the Domestic Violence Protection Act. And so what happens now is the police are showing up with this mindset of not trying to work with people and settle their problems and get them focused back on what's more important. Now it's enforcing the criminal laws and taking somebody to jail. And so that's where it's changed. I can't say if it's a good or a bad thing. In many ways, it was a good thing. It held people accountable for violent behavior. In some cases, it rung somebody's bell as to a substance abuse problem. On the opposite end of it, when the police show up to a family disturbance, and then they think that they're the boogeyman, someone's going to be taking mom or dad to jail in handcuffs. And so the hard ones are when you're doing that in front of kids. You know, I mean, that's devastating when they see mom or dad yarded off by the police in handcuffs, and their 7 or 8 year old kid there watching this whole thing go down. You have to ask yourself what effect that has on them.
How does it make them trust police? Among other things.
Because their minds are so young anyways. And so why would they ever like me down the road? Or how would I ever explain myself to somebody, to a child who I just took their parent away from the home from them, right in front of them like that? And they're not going to understand that because their first loyalty is going to be their parents.
It's especially challenging to me, and I see these in reports, and sometimes I talk to the people directly, that police are called to a scene, a 911 call, maybe not even from the parents, maybe from a neighbor, sometimes from one of the parents. And by the time the police showed up, it's either resolved or there's some tension, but nobody wants anybody to be arrested or working it out. you know, thanks for coming, we're fine.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, someone might be bleeding or there might be some broken vase or something. And here the officer has to come and say, I don't care what your wishes are. The law says I'm going to take someone away here.
Yeah.
That just seems difficult.
It is. It's really difficult. And again, we can't, you know, we can't, in situations like that, we can't act on our own personal beliefs or what we think the law should be. We have to act on what the law and department policy tells us. You make a bad call in a domestic violence situation today, and you're looking at some pretty serious consequences. This is a top priority with the city. I think I'm not out of school by saying it's a top priority for the courts, and it's a top priority for the city attorney's office. Domestic violence, it's a big thing, and it has been for a long time. And I think if we go out on one of these calls, we make a bad decision, don't do what the law tells us we're supposed to do, we'll pay the price for it later, maybe with our careers, especially if something bad happens as a result. And people, again, on the receiving end of this, when we're showing up on these calls, they're not in the mindset to be concerned about what our consequences are. It's all about them, because that's the dynamics of domestic violence.
And I think that's a big misconception people have, that in this state, there's no such thing as pressing charges.
Right.
When the police come, they're going to do their own thing.
Right.
They're not going to be talked out of an arrest. They're not going to be told by some victim, oh, I'm not really hurting, you know, I fell, whatever. And people should know that police are their own agency and they make their own decisions based on what they feel is best.
Right.
And I agree with you, domestic violence is being taken very seriously, and the courts and the prosecutors
sure
do take it seriously. So the process is you'll write a report. Somebody might be arrested, but you'll write a report. And if you feel charges are warranted, you'll file that report and have it sent over to the prosecutor's office, the city
yes.
attorney's. So what happens then?
Well, if the person's arrested and booked into jail, then, of course, those cases get the priority. A city attorney will review the case and decide if it's sufficient to charge, and then they'll file the criminal complaint, of course, and that begins the process in the court as far as the court's involvement. Judge will read the report of the arraignment and determine if there's probable cause, and then there will be a motion to set bail, if bail is set at all, and then conditions of release. That's whether it's a DUI or a domestic violence charge or any kind of a charge. It follows pretty much the same process. If there's not an arrest made, then that case is not given as high a priority as far as review by the prosecutor goes. The prosecutor will get to it at some point and then determine if a charge should be filed or not, and then they're summoned into court. In rare circumstances, a warrant is issued.
How closely do you work with prosecutors on cases?
Well, in my capacity as in the DUI squad, real close, actually. I have two prosecutors dedicated to DUI work. I attended training with one just last week, actually. And then when I was on patrol, I did the same thing. I mean, prosecutors, they're the ones that are going to be going into court and essentially testing your work. And it helps to know what they need to do their job right, ethically. You know, the other angle of that also is I've learned a tremendous amount from defense attorneys. So, I mean, any police officer that counts a defense attorney as a friend has got a great asset there, because you learn a lot from defense attorneys, too, as far as doing your job right.
Yeah, and don't talk to cops.
No. Don't talk to cops. when you know what the prosecutor is going to need to do their job right and do their job ethically, that's a tremendous help, because then they get your work and the right thing is done in the end. And ultimately, a good police officer is going to want the right thing done. And it's not always going to be a criminal charge filed. If you've got somebody who's truly innocent of a crime, it's in our code of ethics, and it's also just the right thing to do to make sure that person's not convicted of something that they didn't do.
And just for the record, you don't get a bonus when someone's convicted, and you don't get your pay docked when a charge is thrown out, right?
No. I get paid every other third day, whether I like it or not. And no matter who gets convicted, who gets charged, your career does not pivot on convictions. No, it pivots on doing the right thing.
Do you think prosecutors in general are more about, you know, what does the law say here, or are they more about kind of the officers that we talked about before, get the bad guys, us versus them kind of thing?
I think today the prosecutors are actually a lot more ethical. And the prosecutor has to pursue justice. They have to be both a defense attorney and a prosecutor when you come into court. They have to advocate for the government. They've got to be the defense attorney. They have to make sure that the person that they're prosecuting actually is treated fairly. Of course, there's going to be arguments over evidence and what is testified to and what's not, what the judge is going to allow to go before a jury. But ultimately, the prosecutor has to wear two hats. They have to actually kind of be kind of a defense attorney, too, because if something goes wrong, they're going to have to retry that case if it's reversed on appeal.
Yeah, or it's tossed completely.
Or it's tossed completely, exactly. And that's why, for me, it's helpful for me to know what a prosecutor needs to do their job effectively. And one thing I'm a fanatic about is witnesses and people that call 911. Like, for instance, I had a case up on the Alaska Way Viaduct where I had a total of 16 people that called 911 about this guy driving the wrong way on the viaduct and ripping into people's, you know, going the wrong direction. He was drunk, and we ended up having to fight with him and everything. Anyways, I ended up listing all 16 people of those in the police report and contacted most of them because I wanted the prosecutor to see and the defense attorney to see all these people that called. So if I didn't touch base with them, at least you or the prosecutor can some way, shape, or form, because maybe that person has helpful information for either side. You might find a witness in there that might be beneficial to the defense, and it's my obligation to expose that. That's an ethical thing. And so I think that's one thing we share with the prosecutors, is to make sure all that evidence is out on the table, so the right thing is done in the end.
So it sounds like it's a concern to you, and a valid one, I think, that making sure that, you know, your T's are crossed and your I's are dotted and give the complete package to the prosecutors. And it's a concern for the prosecutors you're working with that they do the right thing, follow the law, and make sure the right, you know, result happens in the case. What's your feelings on defense attorneys in general?
In general, I can't think of one that I've met that I really didn't dislike. Did I say it the right way?
No.
I haven't met one that I disliked. I think they're good people doing an honorable and difficult work. I think your exposure, I think, and what you stand to lose if a case goes wrong on you is much greater than it is for a prosecutor. A prosecutor represents a government entity, the municipality or the state. They don't represent a live human being. They represent an entity. You represent me sitting here in this room. I mean, as if I was charged with a crime, you would represent me and my best interest and my freedom and my life. And I think that if you lose a case, you bungle a case or something goes wrong, and that's on you, you're going to suffer far more greater than a prosecutor is going to. So to clarify, I haven't met one I disliked. I mean, I've been upset with maybe one or two over a couple of little things they've done, but my uncle is a defense attorney. He just recently retired from ACA. And, you know, I've fished with defense attorneys. I've socialized with them. We've had Seattle police officers that have gone on to be lawyers and became defense attorneys. And you're just part of the system, and I'm just a witness that has information that you might need to for your case. And what happens in court, I'm not a prosecutor. I'm a witness. I don't prosecute a case from the witness stand. I just answer your questions and let you guys work out what the right thing is.
When I did that ride-along, mm-hmm. We stopped late at night at a Starbucks, and there were some other officers around, and we all got a coffee, and mm-hmm. I was in law school at the time, mm-hmm. and they said, "What kind of law do you want to practice?" I think hoping that I would say prosecutor, and I said, "I'm probably going to be a defense attorney. I'm, you know, going to be rule 9-ing soon with ACA, actually." And a couple of them were like, They weren't happy to hear it. You know, there was a guy who was with a police officer who seemed to be on the level, and then this defense attorney who just gets in our way and gets our cases tossed out.
You know, defense attorneys don't get cases tossed out. Evidence does that. The system does that. You just advocate for your client. That's what you're supposed to do. And that's what makes this system in the United States so unique, is we have that fight between you and the government to come up with the purest result that we can It's not always perfect, but it's the best that we can do with what we're working with today. And I don't think I'd have it any other way. You go to some other countries, you mentioned, like, we talked about how I went to Mexico for Christmas with my daughter. And down there, you get arrested by the police, charged with by the government with a crime. The presumption is you're guilty. That's the presumption. You sit in jail guilty, and your sentence has already been determined. And now it's up to you to prove your innocence. Here it's the other way around. You know, you charge the crime, you stand innocent until the judge or the jury says you're guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. And there's challenges, of course, there's confrontation of witnesses, that type of stuff. I have to laugh when I hear a police officer knocking a defense attorney, and then all of a sudden one gets charged with the crime, that defense attorney is our best friend. You know, they're the ones going to go to court and fight for him. But, you know, this thing about we arrested you so you must be guilty is not realistic at all.
I appreciate hearing that. I agree with you. You know, the flip side, of course, is you knock police officers and then someone's breaking your home and you're glad they're there.
Right.
So,
but also flip side is that by my associations with defense attorneys is that I learn ways that I could do my job better.
It's true.
And, you know, really, I mean, I learn a lot from defense attorneys about how I could do my job better. And so that it makes me more effective. It's kind of like, I don't like calling you an opponent, but you know your opponent, and you'll do your, you know, you'll play the game better if you know what to expect from the other side.
We call it opponents, so don't worry about it.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, it's an adversarial process.
Sure, just like on the football field or on a baseball game, it's, you know, it's going to be the same. You have the offense, you have the defense, and the best way to be a good offense is to know your defense, and the best way to be a good defense is to know your offense. And same thing applies in this line of work. And again, play the game fairly. Be fair. Be ethical.
100% agree.
Yeah.
I'd love it. There's a few more questions if you're up for it. My wife actually sent me an article today. It was a little NPR vignette. It talked about hundreds of prosecutors and police chiefs getting together to get people out of prison. Mm-hmm. And the essence was basically, we lock up way too many people for drug crimes, alcohol crimes, when they just need treatment help, need sobriety housing. And we should really conserve our resources for the most violent offenders.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel about that?
Obviously, what we've been doing isn't working. You know, this is a tough, tough issue. It has touched me personally in a number of different ways, where people are struggling with addiction issues, substance abuse, and the damage that I've seen it cause, both resulting from criminal conduct and conduct that's not so criminal. You know, I think that when it boils down to saving somebody's life, if putting them in jail to keep them from doing drugs so they don't die, if that's what it takes, well, what would you rather have? You'd rather have this person dead in the grave, or would you rather have this person locked up? I'll give you a personal example. My sister has been, she died 5 years ago from alcoholism or complications due to alcoholism. If I had the option of seeing her go to jail for a year on a 1 DUI just to keep her out from drinking and keep her alive and get her sober for a long period of time, as opposed to, you know, helping my parents bury her, I would much rather see her in jail, you know, for a long period of time because it would have kept her from drinking. It would have kept her alive, and her kids would have her today, as would my family. But because nothing else worked, nothing else. I mean, we did everything, and it's frustrating. I understand that. But I also don't know about, you know, someone doing 30 years for drug trafficking. One that comes to mind is the guy from the movie Blow, George Jung. You know, you look at how much time he did in prison for all the cocaine trafficking, and they look at all the damage he did to the country too. You know, I don't know. I don't know where the magic bullet is. I mean, we should look at what other countries are doing. You look at other modern countries, what they're doing about drug traffickers, and what drives it. The drug users, the addicts. People talk about treatment. Treatment's great if the addict wants to do the work. So there's a big misconception out there about treatment that you're cured once you go through treatment, and you're not cured. There's no cure for drug addiction or alcohol addiction. There's you just learn ways to live with your disease, but you don't. You never get cured of it. And then if they relapse, and these people, and you've seen it yourself, you know, they come into your office and they charge pretty horrendous things. They did well under the influence, and they're in your office really sorry because they would never do that in a sober state of mind.
I completely agree with you. And so, if the choice is between someone dying and someone being in jail,
yeah,
I would agree with you that jail is preferable. But I don't think those are the only two options for a lot of people. And I do think that people, well, this is a quote from Miracle, people don't leave prison better than when they came in.
They don't. Maybe we need to look at something, maybe we need to look, something, look at something in between. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe we need to look at something that's in the middle ground, that's not quite as restrictive as prison, but then not quite as lenient as full freedom. Maybe we need to look at something halfway in between where people are constantly monitored, that there's relapse programs in place. But again, that's all costly. It costs a lot of money.
It is, but it also costs money to house people.
It does. And then prevention. How do you keep somebody from taking that first toke off of a crack pipe? And this has hit our profession too. As a matter of fact, we talked about this last week. I'm pretty fortunate. I'm afraid of drinking after what I've seen in my line of work. I don't.
Sure.
I gave it up 22 years ago. I'm afraid of what I see, and I don't want any part of it. So I figure I'll just drink iced tea. I'll be just fine. But when I see what alcohol does to some people, and then the remorse they express after they sober up and realize, oh God, what have I done? I want a part of that. But how do we bring that message to more people? I don't know. How do you get people to stop taking that first drink when they shouldn't, or start using dope?
It is a problem. There's addiction issues in lawyering. Very common profession for addiction problems.
Sure.
There's a lot of resources in the Bar Association, but people still want to have to use them.
Yeah.
I don't know if you heard the story about a prosecutor who basically brought meth into court.
Oh, yeah.
And he was stopped at the security guard. And he said, oh, it's my roommates. And it just it didn't hold up, and he got disbarred. He's actually back practicing law. I heard him speak.
He is. Yeah.
And he's very forthcoming, very forthright, talked about his journey, talked about his continued struggles. But he's practicing law, and I'm so super in support of that.
Yeah, so am I. I know what you're talking about.
Yeah. But, yeah, it's insidious. And I personally feel like jails are a good thing to exist. I'm glad they do exist for some people, for the most dangerous elements of the community.
Mm-hmm.
But for a lot of people, they shouldn't be there, and they certainly shouldn't be for that length of time. And I know that I can say that as a defense attorney. You know, I'm obviously in favor of criminals. I'm for defendant rights. But I do feel like it's very powerful when a police officer who is part of the process of getting him into jail says, we should look at what we're doing. Maybe we can make changes.
I think for nonviolent offenses, certainly. If someone's got a long-term sentence for a drug crime, we should probably look, as long as there wasn't any violence involved in it, where it demonstrated a tendency to cause great harm to others. There's always those ancillary issues like, you know, what were they doing to get money to buy their drugs while they're burglarizing somebody's house or breaking into people's cars, selling food stamps or whatever it is they are doing that's going to be harmful to people as well. But I think looking at something that's outside of your traditional incarceration is a good idea. I have never looked at what we have going on in other modern countries, like let's say Germany or Norway or Sweden, what they do with drug-related crimes. I have no idea.
It varies.
We have to look and see. I mean, we should start looking at what they're doing as far as incarceration. They don't jail as many people as we do.
Okay. Wrapping up a little bit, but I do have an important question.
Sure.
A while back, we heard a story about a police officer who went to Arby's, and he wasn't served. They said, we don't serve cops here.
Yeah.
Now, some people have said that was a slight against police officers. Mm-hmm. I think they were doing him a favor. Personally, I've eaten at Arby's before. It didn't sit well with me. So, you know, I've just been saying, like, look, we appreciate your first response. But let's assume for the sake of our discussion that it was a slight. They were saying,
sure,
we don't like cops. Cops not welcome here. How do you feel about when you hear things like that?
Turn around and walk out. Say thanks, sorry about the trouble, or just walk out the door. I don't think we should make it a big deal about it on social media. I don't think that we should make it a big national a headline. I think that if someone were to do that to me, I would just turn around and walk out and just go away for two reasons. First of all, it's not worth it. It's not worth the headache. Go somewhere else. There's other Arby's in Seattle. There's other Subways or other McDonald's or whatever you want to go eat. You can go other places. The other thing is that you're giving them attention is what they want. And why call attention to something like that? So what? They don't want to serve you? Okay, well, you'll go somewhere else. There's also a psychological effect. I mean, if they know they didn't get to you, who wins? Right? I didn't get to that cop. You didn't make a big stink out of it. You walked out of the store and went somewhere else. Okay. I mean, that's fine with me. You don't want to serve me? Don't serve me. I'll go somewhere else. I think a lot of it is it's attention getting. You know, it's a fad.
It's young people.
Yeah, it's young people that think, oh, I'm going to do this and be kind of funny about it. And then maybe I'll make national headlines. They don't think like a lot of young people, you know, they don't think ahead. Their boss is probably going to fire them for it.
I appreciate your comments,
sure.
But I know, you know, we're Facebook friends.
Sure.
And so when we hear about stories like this, sometimes you post them.
Yeah.
You have police officer friends,
yes,
on Facebook, and they comment, and they're really offended.
Yeah.
Why do you think other officers and, you know, officers' wives and just people who are really dedicated to the force are so offended by things like that?
I think they're hurt. You know, I think their feelings are hurt. They want people to like them. They want the public to respect them and appreciate what they do. I think that it's they probably are embarrassed by it, humiliated. But in my book of life, when I look at something like that, I just think that it's not worth making that big of a deal out of it. And I think also, if you want to get even with them, don't let them win. You let them win when you make a big deal out of it. If you don't make a big deal out of it, then you win because you go off somewhere else and you're happy, and tomorrow's another day. You know, I'm not going to let something like that ruin my day, and I would recommend that to my friends too. Don't let it ruin your day. Go someplace else. And eventually it'll turn around and bite them because, you know, they'll think, that person will think, well, that cop didn't, he didn't react. You know, he didn't make a big scene in here, call my boss or anything. They're probably going to have second thoughts. I guarantee they will when they get older.
Versus a police officer throws a fit, you know. And
exactly.
They're going to think, oh, well, I was justified in thinking cops are babies or they're not worth their time.
Exactly. You're just feeding into it. You're falling into a trap if you make even a social media deal out of it. I just don't think it's a good thing for us.
I think we've reached the end of my questions. Yeah. I really, really appreciate you coming in, Eric. We talked for a long time. I think it was some good conversation.
Yeah.
Is there anything you want to tell the people who are listening? I think you asked me how many people were listening. I think six is the number that last time I was here. I might have lost somebody. That might have been me as one of them. But is there anything you want to tell people about policing in general or Seattle police that we haven't touched on?
We're trying. You know, it's a difficult time right now. The department's going through a tremendous transition. I don't want to offer my personal opinion on it, but what I think's been going on. But we're doing the best we can with what we have to work with today. I would really like to see more of us on the street doing preventive patrol. And what I mean by that is preventing your kid, if you're a listener and you've got kids, teenage kids or young adults, keeping your kids from getting shot, keeping your kids from getting involved in criminal activity, keeping them from using dope or drinking in the wrong place or whatever. I think we're always better off preventing crime from happening than we are from doing damage control later, which is one of the personal satisfactions I get from DUI work. So whenever I get one of those DUIs off the road, it's one less bigger homicide we have later. We have one less person going to prison for a long time, one less person who's injured or killed. That's the first thing I'd like to say. The next thing is as it comes to my specialty with driving under the influence, and I already touched on it a little bit, is just don't do it. Find alternatives to getting in your car after you've consumed any kind of substance, whether it's legal or not, or drinking. I've seen this ruin a lot of people's lives. And if you're going to go out and hit the town, consider an alternative mode of transportation. There's all kinds of options available to you besides you getting behind the wheel of your car. and find a safer way home, and everybody will be fine. That's my public service message, I guess. Please don't drink and drive. Don't use drugs and drive. And realize that we're trying. We're doing the best we can.
Things have gotten better in the last few years?
I think so. I've seen just from my line of work, I think that as far as DUI goes, I'm seeing fewer of them. They're getting harder to find now, which is a good sign, I think. We're still having the crashes every once in a while. I had a real nasty one on Sunday. Last summer, I had my first vehicular homicide that I've handled in almost 2 years, which is, that was good. I mean, I'm glad, I'm happy, I'm sad it was a vehicular homicide, but it had gone 2 years without having to respond to one. Nevertheless, it was tragic, it was preventive. If the guy, preventable if the guy just found a different way home. You know, if you're just in that presence of mind. I think the best way to do that is to leave the car at home to begin with when you're out. Find another way home.
It's so much cheaper than a DUI. Hiring me,
yes.
Going through the court fines.
A lot easier on your conscience, too.
There's that. Well, Officer Mitchell, thank
right.
you so much for
okay.
coming in.
All
it was
right.
great talking
Thanks
to you.
Having me.
And we'll maybe have you again.
Yeah, I'd love to.
I think this is going to be a good one.
Sure, good.
Thanks.